I think in the next 3 years, the technology will be there where localized manufacturing can happen at scale. Not this year, but like 2025, I think we can have automated domestic manufacturing. And I think more people are going to do that. That's the one big thing that's going to come out of COVID. People think it's really cheap to make stuff in China. It's not. But the whole advantage is they just have machines set up and they have people to do it. But as they get more automated, it just makes more sense to do more automated stuff here.
If you ask Sean Frank, the future looks bleak. But if you go beyond that surface level feeling of doom, you'll actually find a guy who's thinking ahead and coming up with creative, innovative, and effective ways to build a durable business that can stand the test of time. Sean is the CEO of Ridge.com, a $100 million brand, which you might know for its popular Ridge wallet, but it's much more than that. And Sean has plans to keep the company growing. On this episode of Up Next in Commerce, Sean and I talked about how to stand out in a competitive world of e-commerce and what it means to have a good influencer and sponsor relationship. Plus, we go deep on what we think is coming down the pike in terms of inflation, supply chain, and more. So grab your favorite beverage, cozy up, and enjoy today's episode. Before we get into the episode, I would love it if you could hit subscribe and give the show a rating and review. I really want to know what you think and hear how we're doing. All right, on to the interview. What are business leaders thinking about when they aren't winning at business? Family, travel, the latest TV show? Yes, and maybe. But how about quirky business opportunities or little discussed financial trends or maybe even plant medicine benefits and alternative wellness? Mission Daily is back, baby, and our flagship podcast is better than ever. Mission Daily is the podcast for the business builder, the thoughtful marketer, the team manager, the blue-collar worker looking for new ways to think about life, finances, and health. This is for the people who want to break the status quo and laugh a little or a lot along the way. Join me, Stephanie Postles, and my co-host, Albert Chow, as we address the subjects, thoughts, and trends that business leaders think about but don't often talk about. Tune into Mission Daily wherever you listen to your podcasts. See you there. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Up Next in Commerce. I'm your host, Stephanie Postles, CEO at Mission.org. And today on the show, we have Sean Frank, who's the CEO at Ridge.com. Sean, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
After doing quite a bit of research on you, which would be creepy if we were friends, but because we're not yet, I feel good about this. I was excited to hear all the different opinions you have on this industry and where we're headed in this conversation. So thank you for coming here. But first, let's talk about what is Ridge.com. What do you guys do? What do you sell?
Yeah, so we sell a lot of wallets. So we made a wallet called the Ridge Wallet. It's probably like our flagship product. Last year, we sold over 1 million of them. This year, we'll probably sell 2 million of them. So we're selling a lot of them. But we also make bags, phone cases, like a key organizer thing we're pretty proud of. And just like premium men's accessories made out of cool materials. That's kind of what we do.
Yeah, and what's different about your wallets? Why are they so popular?
Yeah, I mean... It's a functional redesign of what of like a traditional wallet. So like if you're listening to this, you probably have either a card holder that like somebody got you that's just like leather with a couple slots in it, or you have a billfold wallet, which is just like, you know, really big and bulky. And we make ones that are made out of like titanium or carbon fiber or like Damascus steel, just really crazy materials. And they're very, very small. They're like the exact size of a credit card, but they fit like 12 cards if you need them. So we think it's an improvement of an old design.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, especially the little flip wallets where every time I see a man with those in his pocket, I'm like, oh, I feel bad for you. Every time you sit, sorry.
Yeah.
So Ridge Wallet was started on Kickstarter, right? Back in 2014?
Yeah. So I'm not the founder. We can get into the story of how I joined the business. But Daniel Kane and his dad, Paul, we're familiar with Kickstarter. They've done, you know, a couple of different projects before that. They backed a lot of stuff. And Daniel backed what he thought was the Ridge Wallet. Like somebody was making a wallet. And he's like, oh, that's exactly what I want. It showed up in the mail and it wasn't what he thought. So he's like, okay, I'm going to make my thing then. So him and his dad worked on it. That was like 2013 to 2014. Those were like the Kickstarter years. And it worked. They shipped them. People liked them. And then we were able to build like a real business out of it. So pretty lucky.
Yeah. And even to today, there's no outside investors, right?
Yeah. Bootstrap. There's six of us on the cap tables, never raised any money. And that's been hard.
Yeah, I'd say so. So what year did you join and what brought you to the company?
Daniel and Paul never really wanted to hire anybody. They never really wanted to like run teams. It's like not what they're passionate about. They're very much product people. Paul was like a, you know, special needs educator for like 30 years. Now he's fully retired, so he's out of the business. But like he definitely didn't have a background in econ, right? And Daniel did a lot of the stuff himself, but like never really wanted to bring on teams and deal with like HR and all that type of stuff. So they outsourced as much as they could. I was the person they outsourced a lot of stuff to. I owned an agency with my current CMO, Connor. And we started just doing all their marketing. So paid media, email, asset creation, that type of stuff, website. And then we expanded that out to, you know, we were doing their customer service, we were doing their imports, we were doing everything. And it just made sense to merge. So they bought my company. I came in and I've been running as the CEO and everyone's still involved. Daniel, founder of the business, just does product full time. That's what he likes to do. So when we merged, they went from three people working there, father, son, best friend, to 23 people working there. And it was the 20 people that came over from my agency. So very, very seamless. Everything's been going pretty okay.
Yeah, I'd say so from looking at some of your numbers. I want to talk a bit about your growth. So I've heard you mention a few times about tapping into influencers. And I feel like if you would have heard that maybe, you know, a few years ago, people would be like, oh, that's kind of trendy. I'm going to try it out. Now everyone's saying it, but I don't think a lot of brands are really actually tapping into the potential of it and getting good return on that. So I want to hear a bit about your process and how you grew with them and found good influencers, like all the secrets behind how you grew Ridge Wallet.
Yeah, so I really like influencer. It's something I've been really into for a while. Really what it came off of was like, I grew up watching YouTube. That's like the way I spent my time. You know what I mean? Like I can't name any famous people, but I, you know, when I probably watch 8 hours of YouTube a day, right? And I was never really into Instagram. So like, I think the first influencer bubble was people going after like Instagram. And like, they're like, oh, pay to post. And then stories came around. So like, you know, people make some more stuff with stories, but we've always just been super YouTube dominant. I mean, our approach was just like, you know, in 2021, I think we sponsored like 4,000 unique creators. So it's like a huge amount of people, right? And we got hundreds of millions of views off of our influencer content. So it's all, you know, organic, them posting integrations. We're super into it. We're going to keep scaling that up. I think it's hard for a lot of brands to do because you have to be pretty hands-off, right? Like, you can't really have too much creative control over it, right? Like they create content for their audience, so they know it's going to work, right? So you have to just let them do what they're going to do. And a lot of brands can't do that. And the other thing is, it's really hard to scale, right? It's not just spending money on Facebook. Like I could spend $1 million a day on Facebook because I could just click the buttons to make that happen, right? But to spend $1 million in a month on influencer, you're reaching out to thousands of people. You're negotiating thousands of deals. You're sending thousands of pieces of product out there. You're project managing all that. So it's way more like a sales job. And that's where we have a really big team. There's probably like eight people inside of Ridge that just do influencer.
Wow. Okay. And what percent of your marketing budget goes towards influencer marketing?
It's probably only 15%.
Oh, okay.
It's a small percent, but it's really hard to scale past that. That's the whole thing, right? Where, you know, Facebook is still getting 35% of my budget, right? And Google's probably getting 35% of my budget. And, you know, influencers make up a smaller chunk of that, but it takes way more people, way more man hours to get that done. But we think it's a cooler product at the end of the day. You know, if you go on YouTube and type in Ridge Wallet, or you go on TikTok and type in Ridge Partners, you'll see thousands of videos posted in the past 12 months of people just integrating us in cool ways. Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to finding good influencers, I mean, it does sound very manual. How do you know if someone's going to be good? How do you discover talent? I mean, I think a few people that you've gotten to work with kind of blew up. I think there was like a comedian that got really big and a couple other people, but how do you discover the talent early on? Like, how do you go about that? Because to me, it feels like there's so many people right now and everyone's an influencer and everyone wants to be one. And I'm like, how do you even start actually finding the right people?
Yeah. So we say we want to be everybody's first sponsor. So that's like kind of like the mantra of the influencer program over at Ridge, right? So we've worked with some really large people in 2021, like PewDiePie. He's like the number one YouTuber, right? So we did some deals with him. Marques Brownlee, he's got 20 million subs. We do deal with him. Linus Tech Tips, we do deal, you know, we do four videos a month, right? Like, so we have these really long standing, really big partnerships. But that's not the core of the program. The core of the program is people you've never heard of making content you'll never watch, right? It's just like a really, really wide breadth. So we're really trying to give people a, when I mean people, I mean content creators, like a really good first sponsorship experience, right? Like they'll get paid, we send them product, we make it really hands-off, there's no approvals, makes it really, really easy. And that's kind of been the way we've been able to scale that up. How we're finding them, it's super manual. I mean, we have VAs scraping content. We have with a platform called Creator IQ that like we pull in whatever list they have. I mean, it's mass outreach. We're sending thousands of emails every single week. Like we're on TikTok, like commenting like, hey, do you want to work with us? It's as manual as it gets. But then like once people are interested, it's a very seamless funnel. We're like, hey, look, you know, we probably pay less than everyone else who does influencer, right? I think a lot of times people will want to work with somebody, they get a $20,000 quote and they're like, they'll either do it and they'll get burned because like they'll never see the sales results, or they won't do it because it's so expensive. And it's like, yeah, well, we're not going to do that deal anyway. Like, I think that the thing to highlight is like beauty influencers on YouTube, their cost per post is so high because to get into the mechanics, the way YouTube works, there's a lot of dead channels, right? So like, there's a lot of people who have massive subscriber bases, but like don't get very many views per video. And it's because it's very hard to have a career on YouTube for 10 plus years. Very few people have done it. You can count the people who've been able to do it. And most channels just reach a natural endpoint. Their audience ages out, or like they can't keep up with trends or whatever else. And like, there's nothing wrong with that. But then you'll have people who want to sell used, you know, influencer deals based on subscriber counts, which like doesn't matter. It's not a real thing, right? At the end of the day, you're trying to get like a CPM based on views like you'd pay for on Facebook. That's one of the problems with YouTube beauty influencer content, right? Like it'll just be too expensive for the CPM. And also it's kind of like tech content. Like there's a lot of people who make tech content around new and emerging tech, but like there's, you only want to watch one of those videos, right? Like if a new iPhone's coming out, like you're not going to watch three videos all talking about the details of the new iPhone, right? And beauty is kind of the same way, where there's one creator you like, that's the creator you're going to watch, right? Like they speak to you. So there's not a lot of crossover. So what you see is low views, high CPMs. And I think that's what people go to and think about that. Well, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about like one of our best performing channels is a guy who owns a farm and like he's a veterinarian for horses, right? And like he just posts content and like he just happens to have a Ridge wallet in every one of his videos, right? And it's like no one's going to think about sponsoring that guy on YouTube, but YouTube is an everything platform. There's content for everybody. So we're just trying to sponsor as many people and be their first sponsor. So that's really long-winded, but I can talk about influencers for a couple hours if you want to.
Yeah, no, I mean, I actually love digging in on this topic because I do think that is the way of the future, but figuring out how to do it right, like you said, most people are probably going to the accounts trying to find the biggest subscribers and not actually looking at the details of like, what's the engagement in the comments? How many views did they actually get? Is it consistent or not? Versus like your veterinarian dude getting consistent views, probably everyone wants to watch all of his content instead of like one great video that comes out once a quarter or something. It might do really well.
Yeah. And also humans are designed to be lazy, right? So like if you want to do influencer, you're like, okay, well, I'll just choose the three influencers. You know what I mean? Like you're going to pick the three biggest names, right? Or like the three people you might know, right? As a 20 or 30 or 40 year old running a brand, you'll be like, oh yeah, I want to go after Joe Rogan, David Dobrik, and somebody else, right? And it's like, okay, well, like you said, everybody's an influencer. I mean, my wife posts on TikTok once a day and she's got 10,000 followers. You know what I mean? So wow. It's like, there's this whole world of people that you're going to miss if you just go after like these very, very top. And those deals, well, they can be good, right? I sponsor PewDiePie, I sponsor the biggest people, right? Well, those deals can be good, not really a good foray into the system. I think you should identify like, they used to call them micro influencers, but then like, that's so targeted towards Instagram. And I think Instagram's not really a good platform. Just find like 10 channels and just try it out.
Well, what kind of CPM ranges would you give for people like that who are newer, but you see potential in? I mean, is it like $3 CPMs or higher than that? What are you guys seeing right now?
Yeah, so there's been a rush of people getting into the influencer game, and legacy players are driving up costs, right? We're still targeting like sub $10 CPMs for YouTube integrations, right? I used to be directed at $3 CPMs, and now then it went to $5, then it went to $7. We're still targeting sub 10. TikTok, we're paying like $1, right? It's like it's a platform where there is no paid alternative, but there's a lot of good views. So it's just really platform specific. And it also just depends on where the influencer is in their journey of working with people. Like sub $10 is what I'm trying to pay.
Okay. So that makes me think then like an influencer marketplace is not the way to go. I mean, there's a lot of companies popping up right now trying to consolidate influencers, get them on the platform, help you find influencers. But from what I'm hearing from you, that might actually not be the way because everyone's tapping into those people and you want to find the other ones who are maybe not everywhere already and not already working with big marketplaces or whatnot.
Yeah. And also it's like, it's almost like those are designed to fail because of like, oh, it sounds great. Like, oh, we're going to make influencer like Facebook ads, right? Like it's going to be just like that, how you could just scale and activate all these people, get posts and CPMs. Yeah, but the problem is you're dealing with individual people, right? Like you're dealing with dozens or hundreds of individual addresses to ship to, individual negotiations. Like people are going to perform differently. They're going to make content differently. They're going to drop off at different rates. And also we're dealing with assets people don't really own. And to expand on that, what I mean is you don't own the reach of your social channel, right? So like you have an Instagram presence, you have a TikTok presence, you have a YouTube presence, but like, and you have subscribers or followers or whatever on those platforms, but you don't actually own the distribution on those platforms. It's not like, you know, your email list or whatever. A Rich could send an email and it's guaranteed going to those people. And like people will open that where you can do posts and, you know, they just don't perform for whatever reason because the algorithm like it, right? So there's all of those different nuances. And then when you try to do it at scale, it just falls apart. I would kind of relate it to how Zillow lost a bunch of money flipping houses, right? Because individually, you can make money flipping houses, right? Like people do it all day long. But when you try to do that at scale, it's like the little details end up killing you. And that's how I would describe all influencer platforms and most agencies.
Yeah. I mean, do you see a risk then with the people having a presence on other platforms and feeling like they own that audience when maybe like any little tweak could change everything for you and for them? I mean, it brings me back to like we were discussing earlier, my Medium days. And I know we worked together back then when we had a Medium publication. It felt like we did not own our audience. And so any little tweak could completely change that. Do you see a risk when it comes to influencers kind of relying on that, just different platforms that they don't really own either?
Yeah, 100%. If this podcast ends up being for content creators, it's like diversify to something you own as soon as possible, right? Like it can be a Discord, it could be email list, it could be a Patreon. Like I don't theoretically don't own all those things, but just like diversify places where they can actually reach you because your YouTube account can get banned. Your Instagram account can get shut down. Like all of those things can happen. They've happened to really big creators. And also, these platforms are petty. Like, I don't know how much you dive into the space, but like Twitch and YouTube will ban, like if you go from Twitch to YouTube and start live streaming there, they'll shut your account down. They're like, yep, you don't get that anymore. Right.
Yep.
It's horrible, man. So yeah. I think being a content creator is probably a great job, but I think you have to be super smart about it and really try to own something. Right.
Yeah. Ever since the Meta handle got taken.
Yeah.
Like to me, that's like the perfect example of like Web 3.0 of like, you do not own these properties. It can literally get taken and nothing will happen unless you get media exposure on it. Like the only reason she got her Meta handle back on Instagram that was taken from them was because of a media exposure. I guess I'm pretty sure that's the only reason she got it back and returned to her. I'm like, that to me is what the future looks like as a content creator. If you're relying on other people's platforms, you say one thing they don't like, you have a name that they want, it could just get scooped up and taken instantly. Like you don't actually own any of that IP.
Yeah, you're building empires on quicksand. I mean, if we tie back into e-commerce, that's what I say about almost every e-com brand. I'm like, you think you have community, you think you have reach, like you think you have all these things. You are just an effective engine of giving money to Facebook. That's what you are, right? And like, as soon as you stop being an effective engine, everything else falls apart. You're building empires on quicksand. So I think content creators like everything, dude. I think big tech is insane. I don't think we realize how big it is. I mean, I think it's bigger than governments.
There's a stereotype of the average American worker whose life goes something like this. Go to work, come home, consume some kind of entertainment, go to sleep, lather, rinse, repeat. If you're listening to this ad, then I know that life does not resonate with you. For the truly disruptive business leader, work doesn't stay at the office, and unwinding doesn't mean watching TV at night every single night. This is why we've created Mission Daily, a podcast that discusses the trends, habits, and ideas that thoughtful business people are contemplating every day. From quirky business opportunities to interesting investment ideas to the latest research in health and exercise and alternative medicine, and maybe even plant medicine. Who knows where we're going to go, but Mission Daily covers it all. We're releasing new episodes every weekday. So join me, Stephanie Postles, and my co-host, Albert Chow, as we discuss the subjects, thoughts, and trends that business leaders think about but don't talk about publicly, that is. Break the status quo. Tune into Mission Daily wherever you listen to your podcasts. See you there. So, I mean, how are you all planning for the future then when it comes to owning those first party conversations or trying to build a different business, especially in like a world right now that is very competitive? There's so many people popping up. Anyone can sell anything, which can be good and can be bad. Like, how are you positioning yourself to win in the future?
Yeah. So my clear path for Ridge is I'm trying to build the next Yeti. So we're a 9-figure brand, right? So we crossed 100 million in yearly revenue.
Congrats. Nice. I saw the 50 million. I didn't know you crossed 100.
Yeah. So I don't want to say how big, but like we're a bootstrap 9-figure brand. Very, very hard to get there.
Yep.
And almost all of that is digital. Like when I say almost all of it, it's like 97% of it's happening on the internet, right? And we, you know, we could talk about how much we hate big social or big tech or whatever, but that's like what I cut my teeth on the past like 10 years. It's still going to be a huge part of our strategy. You're going to see them continue to go to war. And I think it's going to, like, I think I said this in another podcast. It's like, well, there's a massive storm coming and it's going to flip a lot of boats. So the whole reason we're trying to scale, I just posted this on Twitter. It's like, bro, I don't make a ton of money. It's like the thing is like people hear like, oh yeah, we're doing $100 million a year. It's like, people think I make $100 million a year. I'm like, no, man, fuck it. It's like, I pay so much money in taxes. It's like, it's an insane thing, right? So it's not for really the personal gain of it. Really what it is like, I think the only way to survive is to have the biggest boat possible. That's kind of like what we're going towards. I think Apple's going to launch search. I think Apple's going to start selling people's data back to Facebook, right? And then to Facebook to offset the costs will just like hike up CPMs. I think the supply chain will eventually get better, but in the short term, it's going to get way worse. This year, I've said 2022 is going to be the hardest year for e-com. I think a lot of brands are going to go out of business because they're not going to be able to get stuff. They're not going to be able to compete in a more expensive environment. People are looking for silver bullets. They're like, oh yeah, TikTok. It's going to be like the old days where I can acquire customers for $20. And I can do dropshipping again. It's like, nope, that's totally gone. The only thing I can do is build a very durable business, right? So when I'm thinking about the future, I talk to people and they're thinking about retail expansion. I have a couple of friends. One has 30 stores right now. One's opening 50 stores in the next 2 years. Ridge isn't going to do that. We're not going to open stores, but we'll be a part of their store opening experience. I think that's a good way to do it, right? I think continuing to embrace marketplaces, like I think Amazon's the biggest opportunity in e-com right now. Like, I think it has been for the past 3 years. I think it's going to be for the next 3 years. Because of the supply chain issues, people can't get stuff in. So if you can get stuff in, you have an unfair advantage, right? So I think it's going to disproportionately punish foreign sellers. And yeah, I mean, we're working on doing stuff to actually build community and reasons to come back and reasons to shop again. Like, people always talk about subscription, right? They're always like, you need to have subscription in your product, right? And I think the original subscription was just making good stuff every year. Like, if you look at, I'll use Buck Mason because I buy a bunch of stuff from Buck Mason, but you know, you can also use J. Crew or Brooks Brothers or whatever else, right? Like, legacy men's retailers with seasonal drops, their LTV is huge. It's like $800 for a customer because they just keep making stuff and people keep coming back and buying it. So anyway, that's talked a lot, but that's the way I'm thinking about it. I'm going to keep making stuff and keep trying to sell it to people.
I like that. That's what everyone should do, right? High level. There you go. That's all you need to know, everyone. Keep making good stuff and sell it. I want to go back to the Apple search piece. I mean, when thinking about that, how are you guys even preparing for that? Because to me, it just means whatever you're going to be seeing as a customer is just whatever they decide is best and whoever's paying the most ads. And it's already kind of like that, but like, where will it move to then? Because in my viewpoint, I'm like, I don't see that lasting for long, especially as the world is becoming more decentralized. I feel like something is going to pop up that's going to make for more of an equal playing field to get back to the original days of like the best product actually shows, the product that, you know, has the lowest return rate is going to show or the best reviews. Whereas right now it just feels very jumbled. I don't even know if something's good or not when it's showing up. And I think the trust is lost. And so my thought is like getting to a new version of that, that is more decentralized, not reliant on one big tech company and not just based off of ads.
Yeah. So I would love the world you're talking about, but
that's in my head.
Yeah. Ads is the best business to be in, right? You know, out of the, I think four companies, maybe five companies have ever been worth $1 trillion. I mean, besides Saudi Aramco, the oil company, the five US trillion-dollar companies all have a major ad component, with Facebook and Google only being ad companies. I think ads is the best business to be in. So I think this world where they're not going to extract extortion fees for ads is never going to come. And then the problem is the people who are going to be leading decentralization are the big tech companies. Oculus was the best-selling video game system last year. So like beating Xbox, beating Sony with Oculus, so 20 something million units, beat the Nintendo Switch, right? So anyway, so that's, I think ads are the best business. I think people building decentralization are actually the same people who we're talking about, but they also know what you're talking about is a problem, where Google search is the absolute worst experience. I type something I want in and then I'm like sorting and like choosing, and like people can pay to like give me a bad experience. Like it'll actually end up being an existential threat to Google when Apple Search launches, right? But everyone's going to work towards like the one best answer. And like Mark Lori talks about this, Mark Lori did jet.com, and like now he's just like a smart billionaire guy. He talks about like in the future, you're just going to say what you want and then that's going to be given to you. It's like the one true answer. It'll just be, you won't see any ads at all. It'll just be like handy paper towels. And it'll know everything about you because Apple already knows everything about you. Google knows everything about you. Facebook knows everything about you. They'll just be like, oh yeah, those are the paper towels you like. We're just going to ship them to you. And there'll be some sort of bidding backend system and you'll just be served one answer. And it'll kill most small brands. Like that's what I think we're going toward. But this is me end up being like a conspiracy theorist where I'm like, oh yeah, dude, the only way I'm going to survive the next 10 years is just to be a Yeti or bigger. Yeti's like almost worth $10 billion. I'm like, yep, I got to get there. Not even for personal gain, just because that's the only way to survive the coming tech apocalypse or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, how are you thinking about getting there? Because I know on another show you were talking about, you know, your ROAS and what every company should be at. I think you said maybe 2X or something. And you also had really good numbers of revenue per employee. At one point, you were at like $2 million of revenue per employee, which is very good. Where are you guys at now? Like, how are you viewing that? And how should brands be thinking about, you know, their revenue per employee and their ROAS and all that?
Yeah, dude, I just said this. And people like people said it the wrong way. I'm like, you should try to take out less than 1% of top line revenue in like personal net income after taxes and everything per year for your business. And not because you can't take out more, but because it's short-sighted to take out more. All this is through my lens of being a bootstrap scaling business, okay? And some life lessons I learned from that is, if you grow more than 50% year over year, you will run into problems, right? So like, that's just something I've learned time and time again, is that if you try to grow more than 50% year over year, it's very hard to pay your taxes and then also buy enough inventory for the next year, right? We've had that problem 4 years now, right? But then at the same point, you need to be able to survive, like, I think like a 1.5x ROAS. Like, you know, I think two is a very aggressive target, but like, can you function at a 1.5? Can you break even and pay your costs? That's what you need to be looking at. And then the revenue per employee piece, our target is sub 2 million per employee. And we offset that by like not having a 3PL. We offset that by using a lot of vendors. We offset that by having a bunch of VAs. You know, right now we're at 43 people, but we're at like 15 VAs. And by the end of, you know, Q2, I'll be at 50 VAs in the business. So still trying to hire more people though.
Yeah. That's the constant struggle of today. I feel like for everyone trying to hire good and the right people. Because I mean, I was listening to something the other day that said every, like, you want to learn soft skills because hard skills change every 2 to 3 years. And so there's not really a point in learning hard skills anymore because they change so quickly. And like, oh, no wonder it's so hard to hire people, because you need a mix of both, but things are changing so quick that, yeah, I can see why there's a struggle with companies finding good people.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't think about that. But yeah, I mean, really just like people who can learn new skills. That's like exactly. The most valuable skill.
Yep. So when thinking about building a durable business, you also mentioned retail, which I want to hear more about, like how you all are exploring that, because There's a lot of interesting things happening in retail right now, good and bad. And so I want to hear how you guys are thinking about it. And when I say bad, I'm more thinking about what companies are doing to make their numbers look better. Like, I think I saw something about like Saks Fifth Avenue was like separating out their e-commerce business, which to me is like going back to old school of like, why would you pull those two apart and act like they're different businesses? I know it was for valuations, but they're like calling them two different things. And so the world of retail is starting to feel weird to me, but I want to hear how you're thinking about it.
Yeah. I think it's legacy people trying to survive. I mean, I don't really know how I feel about physical in-person retail. I mean, I talked to a couple brands, I'm not going to blow them up, but like there's a couple high profile brands I've talked to, and one of them is like, yeah, we do $8 million a year per store, which is like best in class. I mean, way better than Warby Parker and Allbirds and all of them. I think Allbirds is doing $3.5 million per store or whatever. So like, I mean, for some brands, it totally works.
Yeah.
But my big hang up is I really don't want to be locked into expensive leases. I don't have to manage in-person teams, right? Like Ridge is like a fully remote company. We've always been remote first. And like we have a couple of values that like, if you're willing to work here for 3 years, you have a clear path to $100,000 a year, right? It's way harder to keep those values with in-person employees because it's way harder to have the growth required for like in-store associates, right? We have to change the way we think about those values to expand into retail. Also, like we make wallets that are designed to be small. So like it'd be really hard to build store concepts. But like I have friends, I mean, I brought up Buck Mason, I don't think I brought this up, but Travis Matthew, like I have friends that run both those businesses and they do retail extremely well. I think if Rich does retail, it's going to be a part of what they do. I'll do exclusive SKUs for them. I'll put in marketing dollars. I'll put in event dollars. I'll do that type of stuff to really highlight their retail experience and just be associated with that. That's the way I want to do it.
Okay, cool. And tell me more about supply chain then. Are you guys building here in the US? You said that you didn't want to be messing with, you know, shipping things and getting caught up like that. Like, what are you all doing to maybe not have to go through what everyone did the past year or so?
Yeah, so just we got really lucky because like I probably come off like this, but I'm a paranoid person. So like I've always
you don't know.
I've always had a couple of years of inventory on hand. We're non-seasonal and stuff doesn't go bad, so I can have a bunch of stuff on hand. We've been very much sheltered throughout the supply chain stuff, and we have small units that I can air freight if required. So like we've been pretty okay. Like we have a lot of stuff coming from basically every country. But I think in the next like 3 years, the technology will be there where localized manufacturing can happen at scale. So not this year, but like 2025, I think we can have automated domestic manufacturing. And I think more people are going to do that. The one big thing that's going to come out of COVID is like people think it's really cheap to make stuff in China. It's not. But the whole advantage is they just have machines set up and they have people to do it. But as they get more automated, it just makes more sense to do more automated stuff here anyway. So anyway, that's what I think we're going to. 2025, making a lot of stuff in America.
Yeah, I mean, I do too. That's where I think people probably think I sound paranoid when I'm like, if you look at the trade deficit, it's like worse than it was in 2008. Obviously a very bad recession. A lot of it was because of that. I mean, obviously if we're not making much and we're not sending it out and we're not getting paid for it, like I don't think great things happen. And it's worse than it was back in 2008, way worse. So I'm like, something has to change or else we're headed into bad territory, which you already think we're headed that way. So I guess we can both be pessimistic together.
Yeah, yeah. I think pessimistic at different ends of the coin, right? Yeah. I think the e-com ad market is going to be very difficult to maneuver. But I think China's going to implode is what I think is going to happen. There's like a bunch of dark debt. It's going to just not make financial sense to do business there. And then I think we're heading towards a global recession that's going to not hurt the US as bad because of this thing called the milkshake theory.
I have heard about this.
Yeah, yeah.
But explain it for people who don't know.
Oh man, I'm not the right guy to explain it, but it's 88% of all global trade happens in US dollars, right? So like we have this very unique problem where like, I mean, it's a global problem. It's that like everyone has US dollar debt and there's this massive demand for US dollars. And we just printed a bunch of US dollars. Because everyone freaks out that we just printed a bunch of money, but everywhere printed a bunch of money. So it's like the whole money supply grows pretty evenly, right? But then there's no demand for name a country's currency. Like no one actually wants that except for people inside that country. But Saudi Arabia is buying weapons from us in US dollars and then selling oil to Europe in US dollars. And they're all servicing debt in US dollars, which means there's just massive demand of US dollars. And that explains why the dollar is at like a 52-week high, even though we just printed $2 trillion. Like, it just keeps going up. So anyway, all this stuff's going to happen. I think it's going to lead to a, you know, inflation will happen just because there'll be a massive demand, right? And I think US asset prices are just going to keep going up. But then I think the global economy is going to get really, really hard because they're servicing US dollar debt.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it'll be interesting to watch because I'm still watching that inflation number. I'm like, I don't know, this isn't looking good. And they already said before inflation was like transitory and it was going to go away, and it didn't. I mean, it went away for a little bit in like, I think it was like Q3, and it just like came right back, and lumber prices shot back up, and they like revised it, and they were like, oh yeah, sorry, it's not transitory inflation, it's just here. And now they're going to adjust the CPI numbers to make it look a little bit different, AKA to me, they're just going to try and make it look better than it actually is. That's the only part I don't trust. I'm like, if you're adjusting CPI numbers, something is happening that's not good if you have to make something look different than it is, unless you're actually including more things in it that need to be included. But we just got very off topic, which I thoroughly enjoyed though. So what are some maybe big bets that you're making right now within the company that you like don't know if they're going to pay off or not? I mean, I heard, you know, big on influencers, you're on TikTok, you're Google, Facebook. I mean, pretty, I'd say, you know, what a lot of other companies are doing. What are you doing right now that's maybe different and like a moonshot that you don't know if it's actually going to work, but you're excited about it?
Yeah. The biggest gamble we're making, very transparently, is in product. We sold millions of wallets last year. Like, we've very much been about selling this particular wallet design to people. We launched like a key organizer, and like that did extremely well, right? And the big thing we're doubling down on is just like making new stuff for people, right? Like taking the same DNA of the wallet with the materials and just bring it over to more stuff. I mean, like, everything else I don't even consider like a big crazy bet. Like, we're really good at marketing. We're going to keep marketing, right? I'm going to keep making content. I'm going to keep hiring the best people, right? And like, you know, we're at 40 something people right now. By the end of the year, like 80-ish people, something like that, right? And I don't consider any of that a gamble. I'm like, yeah, we're going to hire people. It's going to be great, right? The real, like, every year we have like a themes at Rich, which I know probably sounds like stupid or whatever, but like this year's theme is like endurance, right? We're trying to build the foundation of a business that can go on for a very, very long time, right? Like, we're trying to IPO in 2026. Like, that's like the clear path I have for this. Last year was about professionalization. So like getting real accountants, getting real lawyers, getting all the type of stuff that like big companies need. And then this year it's about like the processes to like endure the next 5+ years or whatever. So all of that's what we're thinking about. None of that I consider a risk. The biggest risk is like, we're going to make watches this year. And like, you know, I feel really good about them, and I hope customers feel the same.
Yep. Oh, that's cool. Yeah. I mean, do you make laptop covers yet? Because I was reading a whole article about how your information can just get swiped off a laptop when you're like, you know, I don't know, traveling, walking around the street or whatever, just by people with their scanners, kind of like what they can do with your phones. I'm like, I think I need a laptop protector.
No, I haven't heard that. Send me that article because I'll probably make that.
Okay, make that. I don't know if it's true or not, but either way, I'm like, it sounds true. If you can get it off my phone, you can definitely get things off my laptop probably. So just need a good little covering to make sure no one can swipe my awesome kid photos.
Right.
And everything else important. Well, let's move over to the lightning round. The lightning round is brought to you by Salesforce Commerce Cloud. And this is where I ask you a question and you have a minute or less to answer. Are you ready, Sean?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, what's your favorite Ridge product outside of the wallet? Because that's what you're known for.
The knife. We have a very cool knife.
Okay, what's special about it? Why is it cool?
It's like made out of carbon fiber. It's just like a really well-made knife. It's kind of like, well, like, we're very inspired by James Brand, like treating men's accessories as jewelry, basically. But I don't know if I was going to answer, the key case. The key case is really, really cool. It's a new thing we made. They're sold out, so you can't get one, but
darn,
I really like it.
Cool. Now we're all just, you'll have pent up demand until you get that back in stock then.
Yeah, I think they're going to sell. We made them November 1st. They were sold out by November 10th. So like just immediately sold out.
Wow. I also need something cool to put on my keys now that I think about it. I'm like, keys are so lame. Why can't we make them cooler? I don't know.
For sure.
Another good product idea for you. Bring it to the company. What is the most surprising thing since becoming CEO? Like, what did you not expect?
I guess I don't get as many emails as I thought I would. That's always been a big concern, is that I would get like way more emails. But no, I'm very open. People can DM me on Twitter and I'll book time with people to talk about stuff. And most people don't do it. So what that taught me is most people like to think they have ideas that are being held back and they just need whatever, but they don't take the steps to actually get it done. Cause you can totally DM me and usually get a phone call with me. But anyway.
Good. What's the best piece of business advice you've ever received?
I don't know, man. It's very hard for me to recall. This is off the top of my head. Basically, anything on Twitter I read is probably pretty good advice. I just go on there.
Anything? Wow. Yeah, yeah. You're really leaving yourself open there.
I don't know, man. I'm not one for business books, but no. I talk to smart people all the time. They're always giving me good advice.
Yeah. On Twitter, you're always DMing people.
Twitter, or I mean, I have a core group of friends in LA. So like, you know, there's people running $100 million plus e-com businesses. There's very few of us. So I have a friend, David, or a friend, Jeremy. They both run those businesses with their wives, and they're one's in the female hair space, one's in the vitamin space. And they're both super solid guys. I've talked to them all the time. So yeah, just find a little communities I've got to talk to. And they're a couple years old. They're like in their 40s. So they're always just giving me just good advice in general. Like, okay, here's some advice David gave me. Cause I was talking about how like I have the Delta card from Amex so that I can get diamond status so that I can get first class upgrades. Uh-huh. I explained this whole scheme to him and he was just like, just pay for it. He's like, I'm telling you, like the mental space that's taking up to like how to game to get first class upgrades. He's just like, just buy them. It's like, oh yeah, like that's so stupid.
Yep.
You should just deploy capital in ways to free up mental space. That's what he was trying to tell me. That was good advice.
That is good advice. I like that. All right. And the last one, what's a favorite either e-commerce tool or piece of technology that you're most excited about right now?
Yeah. So we spent more money on Facebook in 2021 than we ever have. And we did at a better ROAS. So our blended ROAS went up year over year. So not only did we scale a crazy amount, we spent way more money at a better return. We did that because of a thing called Northbeam, which is like it's like a first party data platform thing that like basically when the iOS update fucked over Facebook, we were protected from it because Northbeam had its own pixel, its own data, could model all that stuff out for us. There's a couple people doing a similar thing. I think Triple Whale did something similar, but we've just been on Northbeam for like 2 or 3 years. So I think I've been super stoked on that. That's one thing. The other thing is there's a post-purchase survey thing. I don't remember what it's called. Enquire Labs, I think it's actually called. I think SMS is way too overhyped. I personally think NFTs and Web 3.0 are a little too overhyped right now. It reminds me of when people thought AI was really cool like 4 years ago. And then it's like, okay, where's all the AI that you guys were talking about, right? Will that be proved wrong and all that type of stuff? My CMO, Connor, owns Bored Apes and is like really into the whole thing. So I hope I'm wrong on that. But yeah, what I like is Enquire Labs. It's a post-purchase survey. I think that's really cool.
That sounds cool. And the more, the more simple things compared to all the buzzy catchwords right now. That's great. Cool. Well, Sean, thanks so much for hopping on the show today. This was super fun. Where can people learn more about you and Ridge.com? Other than going to Ridge.com, I guess, but where can people learn more about you?
Yeah, you can go there. You can email me, Sean@Ridge.com. I try to read every email that comes in. Or I'm on Twitter. You can just follow me on Twitter.
Love that. All right. Thanks, Sean. Hey, listeners. Thanks for tuning into this episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. It helps spread the word, and I would greatly appreciate it. See you next time. Thank you for checking out another epic hour of business insights and inspiration on the Up Next in Commerce podcast. If you like what you've heard and you're interested in partnering with us to bring your brand to a growing audience of e-commerce experts, reach out to me at Stephanie@mission.org to get the conversation started.